To begin with, I would like to see the following people stand up. Robert Creo, Joe Newfield, and Dick and Anna G. Okay. These are fellow team members for the OC service team from the MLC. And they're not all, that we have some others as well, but they're here today because this is an important day. We're taking a significant step forward. And I just want to say it's a real honor to be serving as a member of that team, but also to come back and be involved with you guys. And I've had so much joy and personal growth working with the Los Angeles Church. And so I want to tell you something a little bit about myself that you may not know before we proceed with this idea of developing elderships. And that would be the idea that, you know, I've been an engineer for 10 years. I was 25 years in the full-time ministry, had done, you know, I've been deacon, evangelist, elder, teacher. But now then I went into consulting, but really what I do mostly in the last year and a half is research. And so it's funded research. And it started on a particular day. I was actually on a call with a bunch of teacher types. Robert was on that call. And I felt like in Christian history, we're not learning, in the Christian world, we're not learning from all the mishaps. Forget the tribes for just a second. And there's so many things that went wrong in the last 20 years and crises and scandal and power struggles and splits and whatever. Some financial, some bullying pulpit ministers and abuse and toxicity. That toxicity, toxic churches and trauma are like the big Googleable words these days, right? And for a reason. So I called up Robert after this call and I said, I've got to do something different with my life. Because consulting for a church is like a one-off. But if I could use my background in theology, engineering, risk management, conflict management to come together and say, let's study these stories. So I found some donors to support me, but they said, we need to know what's going to come out of this. And I said, here's what can come out of it. All the lessons learned made public, along with the stories, and accessible to the average congregant, the board members, the pastors, the elders, the evangelists, the HR people, the admin, the all the people that have, you know, general counsel, they would have access to these lessons. And I've completed 4 studies already. And these movements and megachurches and faith associations include Crystal Cathedral Ministries. I finished that one. It'll be like Harvest Bible Chapel, the Crossroads Movement, Hillsong, Willow Creek, Acts 29. And, you know, all the rest, including the trajectory that I've lived through. You know, I was baptized in 1981, but I've been like in 4 movements without moving. And I've seen a lot of stuff. And the project is called Lights On. But here's some of the patterns, and you'll see why it ties into today. I've seen that where there's a crisis within the lifetime of the founder, and you get to see the response of the founder, that there was a self-protective inner circle. There was top-down charisma-style pyramid leadership. There was a resistance to good processes, including investigations. And the top leader was under-tethered, meaning there was really nobody truly in their life. But the other one is hand-picked boards and elders. And we're not going to have hand-picked boards and elders in the Orange County ministry. And we're not even asking the congregation to pick him. We're asking the Holy Spirit to help us see them. Okay? So that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about what's in the Bible and in history that we can learn from, but also we're going to look at some wisdom for today and a customizable process. So these are the places that I've either helped very closely with what like I'm doing today, or I've come in because there's been a mishap. And help them, you know, get things right-sized. And those situations are confidential, but I will share some of the lessons learned from those endeavors. So this is the series sequence of the material. It'll be online. The slides will be available. I have a written document that's behind all of this that will also be available. But this is what we'll be doing today. So now, in a typical eldership, you have standard responsibilities and occasional challenges. A standard responsibility would be, you know, like you see up there, it's marriage stuff, family stuff, ministering, getting behind the scenes, pastoring, all that kind of good stuff. Occasionally, if they have the gift, preacher. Not everybody has all the same gifts, so there's a little bit of difference between elders and what they can bring to the congregation. Really, also, if there's a reputational problem with something that went down in the church, I think it's the elder's job to engage, whether it's with the media or any other entity, to fix anything that has gone wrong. Then there's the occasional challenges. I want to park here for just a moment. There are things that happens in a church that without a suitable sized eldership and without an elder who's must be self-aware, this can be very draining. I mean, so three of the things on that right size column, I immediately dealt with in the 6 months that I became an elder. Within 2 years, I dealt with everything on that right size side. And there were scary things where, it'd be like, we want to make sure we're locking the doors at night. You're dealing with mental health. You're dealing with people that are upset because their income is threatened because you've taken a stand like on a pyramid scheme or something that's going on in the church and exploiting people, things like that. And complex marriage and divorce and remarriage issues. You know, even though I have a master's in theology, I find that really hard to sort out. You know, to look at all the verses and get God's intent and what about this situation and that. And a lot of eldering is a team sport. Really, most of it is. And sometimes you have to defer on therapists, counselors, teachers, evangelists, other people, administration, people that have background in things that you don't, because these can be complicated. And it's way too much for like a couple like James and Vicky to be the sole custodian of the problems. And I love James and Vicky. These are neat people. They're great. And they're present and they're all in. We just need multiple people in that capacity. Otherwise, they will get hurt because it's just too much. You know, within a couple of years of being an elder, I didn't put on any weight, but my stomach grew. I developed some health conditions, eczema. I mean, I just was not the same person that I was 2-3 years earlier. I stepped out at the 5-year mark exactly to the day, April 9th, 2000 to April 9th, 2005, just to kind of figure out who I was after all that I had been seen and so forth. So when we look at elderships, there are certain scriptures that are prominent, and then there are certain questions that have to be either asked by the congregation or the vetting team that looks closer, I'll talk about that, or the individuals themselves. There are some challenges, some risk, and what can really be handled by these individuals. The scriptures, the Old Testament has a whole lot about what can happen. You know, crimes, spiritual matters, burdens, all sorts of issues that do come up. And then helping the flock remember their history. In Deuteronomy 32:7, it said, remember the old days, consider them, and then ask the elders. That's an indication that elders are older. They've been around, they've seen a lot. You know, the qualifications for dispute handlers, Jethro talked to Moses about it. 40 years later, Moses talked to the community about it in Deuteronomy 1, 9 through verse 18. One of the criteria for these dispute handlers of levels of competence. It wasn't hierarchy. It was some are good for handle 50, groups of 50, some hundreds, some thousands, whatever. But one of the criteria is a word that could be translated either experience or seasoning. And one commentator called that a catalog of experiences. Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'll be 65 this summer. I have a catalog of experiences. One of the smart things I did early on is keep really good records of everybody who was ever upset with me, every major decision I made, every problem I handled. And unfortunately, before the days we had everything on hard drive, some of it was in written records. And I had a moving disaster where about a third of our stuff was spread out over a quarter of a mile in Ohio. And I lost a lot of stuff, including a letter from somebody that didn't like a decision I made from like 1988. And I just always tried to reach out to them and see if I need to make something right. Most likely, there was some truth to it. I was a young minister handling a termination. But throughout it all, I've kept good records. It's really important to be aware of our history. One of the things I'm doing with the LA Church is archiving its history. It's a thing called the resiliency system. We put it on Park at COVID. We're going to reset it. But it's knowing the whole history, the major flashpoints, what went wrong, what changed because of what we learned. And we need that in our churches. In the New Testament, it's pretty much the stories that we all are familiar with. The Acts 15 story is just one of my favorite. It's loved by church consultants because it's a change management story that emphasizes openness, inclusion, interdependence, transparency, good process, and so forth. Acts 20, Paul's admonition to the Ephesian elders, watch out for. And the process is for selecting elders. You know, Titus 1 is more about, hey, we got a problem. Point elders in all those places. That's a hands-on directive, probably not as inclusive of a process. There's a crisis, okay? 1 Timothy is more of a casual pastoral direction. Even the qualifications list are not exactly the same. And that's probably because the qualifications are not prescriptive, they're descriptive. They're about the essence of what we're looking for in both elders and elders' wives. And so forth. So those are the main scriptures that show they get involved in handling money, also laying their hands on people, like in the case of Timothy and so forth. Now I want to talk about to the potential shepherds here right now. There's a story in Sky Jethany's book. I think I said it right. He's the author of With, but this book is called Immeasurable. And he talks about a town in Turkey where on the top of a mountain, or near the top of a mountain, a single sheep ran over the cliff. And all 1,500 other sheep nearby followed and went over the cliff. The first 450 died. The next 1,050 lived because they bounced on the corpses of the sheep. But in his book, he says, sheep are stupid. Now, Christians are not stupid. People are not stupid. But there are situations where we act very stupid. Okay, and this is a very well-known principle established within anthropology and history and neurology, that when we are anxious and we're around anxious people, we become collectively stupid. Okay. You can't even avoid it to some degree unless you know these principles and you figure out, how do I become differentiated? And so I've gone into churches. I went into a denominational church where the denomination is about 500 years old, goes back to the Reformation, and there was two organizations that were connected. One was a church and one was not a church, but they were both connected. And they had an open forum disaster meeting in a summer that was unlike anything they had ever seen before. And somebody in that church used to be our neighbor, with Trisha and me. And they asked Trisha and I to get in and help because they learned about what I do. I turned it down for some reason. I think it was my schedule, but they asked again, so we got in there. So this open meeting that was so reckless and did so much harm was all on the basis of this thing that the pastor did, or the head of this other organization did. But as we got down to unpack it, the crowd was wrong. They blamed the wrong perpetrator. And the actual perpetrator got away with it. Was on his way out the door, never to be seen again. I have seen that repeated in so many different ways. In my training at Lipscomb University, it was, the presenting story is never the real story. It's not because it's a lie. It's usually because people don't understand their story. They drew their conclusions too quickly. They need some impartial person to come unpack and get, you know, what's going on. But shepherds, you ought to aspire to be the most differentiated and Jesus-like, shepherd-like to the sheep, so that you don't get caught up in crowd anxiety and crowd anger. Because we humans can be really stupid when we move together in madness. We can blast out terrible emails. We can do all sorts of crazy things, and then later on we go, what just happened? So the elders should be calm, engaged, present, accessible, and go to that place with God that they handle these things really well. So in Ezekiel 34 is the place where we go most frequently to describe the heart of a shepherd. And down in the middle, the Lord says, I will tend to them in a good pasture, and the mountain heights of Israel will be their grazing land. They will lie down in good grazing land, and there I will feed them in a rich pasture of the mountains of Israel. I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the Lord. I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak, but the sleek and the strong I will destroy. I will shepherd the flock with justice. The shepherd is concerned with those who are strong because they're overlooking the needs of the weak. As for you, my flock, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I will judge between one sheep and another, between the rams and the goats. Is it not enough for you to feed on the good pasture? Must you also trample the rest of your pasture with your feet? Is it not enough for you to drink clear water? Must you also muddy the rest with your feet? Entitled people hurt flocks. And shepherds are to make sure it's an even playing field. He says, I will save my flock, and they will no longer be plundered, exploited, manipulated, coerced. Now keep watch over yourselves, Paul says to the Ephesian elders, and all the flock of which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Be shepherds of the church of God, for which he bought with his own blood. I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come in among you, will not spare the flock. Even from your own number, men will arise and destroy the truth in order to draw away disciples after them. So be on your guard. You know, I haven't met a whole lot of wolves, but I have met some. And the long arc of their lives never turns out good. I don't think a wolf is somebody that disagrees or leaves in a huffy way or causes problems. Because we all cause problems sometimes. Have you ever caused? I've caused problems. Okay? I don't think we should label wolves as somebody that we strongly disagree with about church matters or doctrine or whatever. But there is a kind of person that's so conniving, and they can even profit on their connivingness. And they destroy, and they leave a path. So much so that people are afraid of them. Institutions like churches, schools, universities are afraid of these kind of people. They create havoc. And I never could imagine when I first read this passage a few years as a Christian, really, there are wolves? Really? Oh, yeah. It's been a problem for about 2,000 years. In 1 Timothy 3, here's a trustworthy saying. Whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. Now, the overseer is to be above reproach, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him, and he must do so in a worthy manner of full respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his family, how can they take care of God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or may he become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. He must also have a good reputation with outsiders so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. So that's the really the text that would be the centerpiece for most of what we're looking at here for elders here soon, very soon. Now, so here's some lessons learned in church history. So around 95, Clement in Rome was pushing for a hierarchical view of elders, and by the time Ignatius of Antioch comes along, we not only see a hierarchy, but they split the overseer away from the elder and make that two roles. So we see the beginning of a pyramid, and over the next 100 years, it does take a while, but over the next 100 years, that becomes the prototype that eventually became the Roman Catholic Church. And so it leads to clergy, laity kind of things. Now, it wasn't indeed a reaction. There was a lot of threats going on, especially for Antioch, where Ignatius was from. And so one way to, you know, clamor down and hold down the fort for a church is to have all authority centralized in one person. But it got to the point you couldn't have a baptism or even communion unless the bishop was present. And that's clearly seen by historians as a reaction. Flash forward to the restoration movement that spawned the Churches of Christ. Some people call it the Stone Campbell movement because Barton Stone, Thomas Campbell, and Alexander Campbell were the founders of this unity movement going back to the early 1800s. And so between the 1880s and 1930s, you had churches that were, they were elder-led, but evangelists were also like revivalists. So they would go into a town for maybe a couple of weeks, up to 2 years, and then would leave. And during that time, they'd be studying, preaching. Sometimes the meetings would be 6 nights a week. And then a lot of people would become Christians, and when they would leave, the elders and the rest of the church would strengthen those members. And it was indeed a good partnership. It was a model that really worked well, even in the Churches of Christ. But the problem is, it's not very practical for an evangelist. Like, they start to have kids. Like, they want to have plant, you know, start somewhere, you know, have a place to go back to. Well, what happened over time was that the full-time stationed evangelist idea didn't work out, but elders got behind the idea of calling them preachers because it doesn't sound like they have any authority. They're just there to preach on Sunday, teach on midweek, maybe a Sunday night, and then have an altar call. They're ready to focus on baptisms every single Sunday. Services were visitor-oriented, but the church didn't study the Bible with people. They weren't really making disciples. That's even according to the Church of Christ historians. And so preachers often got muzzled by the elders, very discouraged, and elders had control. Flip that is the International Churches of Christ, evangelist-led. They stayed longer, and then they hand-selected elders most of the time, not always, and not even that their choices were always bad. But it made the church vulnerable to an inside inner ring, rubber-stamping kind of elderships. And I know many elders in the church, in International Church of Christ, that were not rubber-stampers. But I know some that didn't stand up when they needed to. And so these evangelists were usually appointed from the outside. Now, I'm going to say something that might seem controversial. This is a personal opinion. Feel free to disagree with me. But when you define denomination the way that the original study series is from Kit McKean, the International Church of Christ was more denominational than many denominations. I mean, it was centralized. Tried this uniform approach. Even though many of us rejected this uniform study series and taught more accurately, that's what happened. And this led to the crisis that we had, because this tethering issue is not just about Robert Schuller or Bill Hybels. It was what happened in our world, and we experienced a crisis, as you well know. If you're young, you don't know that, but I just gave you for free an insight as to what happened. Okay, but it ties in to what we're doing here today, you know. So after 03, we find that we have evangelists and elders and administrators and teachers working together better than ever before. New prototypes emerged. The perspectives of members mattered so much more. They were included. Vetting became more inclusive. Communication was improved, which engendered greater trust. Salaries were decided not from an insider group, but members who had backgrounds in nonprofits and could help us have reasonable objective criteria for pay. Outcomes were less predictable about who became elders, which was a really good thing. And so, like in Atlanta, this is what prompted me to do research on this. Atlanta, during the crisis, they had 232 names brought before the church. Single people, young people, people on the verge of divorce, they didn't do any groundwork. It contributed to why the church at that time blew up into like 6 or 7 different separate churches. Not that that's a bad thing, having multiple churches in a city, but it was messy. And that's why it's important to really study these things out and develop good processes, which is what we're talking about here. So confidentiality as in the processes became important. There might be reasons within a future elder's household that are very delicate. And then there's the subject of believing children. What does that mean? So we'll talk about that because it's so important. So in the low end of the spectrum, if the kids were good when they were little kids, oh, they're qualified to be an elder. I saw a church have that standard, and their eldership blew up. And today it has no elders. And it had four at one time, and it blew up, power struggle, whatever. They didn't have the right people for that posture. On the other end, position five, all the kids are Christians. All of them became Christians. All of them are adults, and they've never fallen away. Well, that's just unsustainable. That's saying that a mom and dad who raise their kids and the kids become Christians and they're Christians for a while, but by the time that kid is 35 years old and wanders, that's now a reflection on the parents. That's ridiculous. You know why? Because our wandering is not a reflection on God. It's a reflection on us. So these middle positions are more like, well, did at least one become a Christian? And the others are maybe too young, or most of them are still Christians, even though one left, they have a good relationship with their parent. I don't want to be dogmatic. I think the answers are between two and four. But I want to give you additional insight that I learned very recently. There's a scholar named Matthew Bates. His Gospel Precisely book came out last year, was the number one book on Christianity Today. His other two books emphasize that faith and the New Testament is not the proper translation of the word, the Greek word, in many cases. Whenever it's a relationship to the Lord or a king or a ruler or an entity like a kingdom, it's better translated allegiance. So saved by allegiance. That makes much more sense because people that say we're saved by faith and faith alone, that just usually means I said a prayer, I believe, I assent to that Jesus exists. He covered my sins, now I'm going to go live my life the way I want. That was very popular for a long time. But allegiance speaks so much better to the heart of what's mentioned. So right here, an elder must be blameless, faithful to his wife, a man whose children are allegiant and not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. That's a powerful variation. So my recommendation is that for Orange County, you have elders where they've been able to establish they can raise kids to become Christians, and their kids in general are allegiant to the family, but you don't overly nitpick on things you don't understand. And you trust a vetting team to look at that stuff with an air of confidentiality. So anyway, let's move on. Some other aspects of wisdom. In a couple cases, not many, but a couple cases, and somebody became an elder, and all of a sudden they were like Smeagol from The Lord of the Rings. I've got the ring. I've got the ring. And they would go micromanage the ministers, the children's ministry, and say, we're going to move children's ministry from this room to that room and this, that, and whatever. And it was very disruptive. Another piece of wisdom, we've got to really be mindful of conflicts of interest. An evangelist who's also an elder, that could become too powerful. So we've got to find a way to mitigate that. You can do that through some good understanding of how you're going to deal with that to make sure it's not heavily leveraged in decision making. I saw a process, a really good process, in a church where an evangelist wanted to hire his son. He thought he was best for the job. And so we created an independent process for that decision to be made. And somebody else applied for the job, and his son didn't get it. But the evangelist was so encouraged because it was a really good process. The people behind the process were so impressed by the evangelist's son that when a new opportunity came up that was much more to his role, he was a single brother, he ended up getting hired for that role. And so it just speaks to the church when there's objectivity and impartiality that takes place. It's important not to confuse likability with qualifications. I'll give you an example. What about the elder who's not super warm. His EQ is not that great in social settings. But when it comes to helping out marriage and family and kids, all of a sudden the light goes on and he knows exactly what to do. I don't want to rule out people because of quirks. I have quirks. And you'll figure out probably by the time I'm done with Orange County. Maybe you already have, okay? But we have quirks. We're all broken at some level. We have stuff from the past that, you know, and we get in places. We do need to recognize that particular thing. If you have a concern about a candidate when their name comes up, think through, is it from an event in the past? Is it something that needs to be talked through? Can you talk to them first before going to the vetting team? I've seen a situation where names were brought before the church, a date was picked 2 weeks out, the candidate who was going to, one of the candidates ended up telling their family from outside the state, they all bought tickets. You know what happened. So some people complained about the elder's wife, domineering, so forth, and the eldership never happened. Those people that bought tickets were hurt. And it was humiliating. So let's go first to the person, if we can. If there's any reason we can't, get advice, because we really want to honor people in the process. The church should be honored. The candidates should be honored. Okay, now I'll go quick on this. But there was one church I went into where this brother that was so pastoral, the go-to person in a whole state. But when he mismanages two crises in such a big way, and so we were actually coming in to do mediation, not look at the eldership. So my wife and I got in. We had a successful mediation. And they were appointing new elders, and we figured out, and this elder figured out, you know, I have family of origin stuff that when I get involved in these high-pressure situations, I freak out. And so we identified which of the new elders had history and legacy and even professional experience to make them better with conflict and crisis. And we help them say, what am I good at? What am I not good at? What do you think I'm good at? What do you think I'm not good at? And get into proper lanes. So this slide I'm going to move quick because I'm going to re-explain it in the next one here. So this is the process that we are in. We are asking for you by next, the 10th, to submit names. We'll tell you how to do it in a second. To submit names of those who you believe, after studying and prayer, would be really great candidates. You can mention reasons why, but just their names and reasons why. And then if you have questions, put them in the same email. Myself, James Willis, and Robert Carrillo will be the ones looking at this email. And then what we'll do is we'll have a team of two teams. One team are those who are going to actually do the interviewing, who are the most qualified and impartial. And a bigger team will make sure we represent all the six ministries, the evangelists, and key roles in the region, so we have our eyes on something together. And they'll be part of also feedback on this process and what we come up with. And then, at a certain point in time, we will announce to the church, and then we will appoint these men as elders. You, this region, will appoint these people as elders. We'll discuss that at another time. And if there's a problem on April the 7th when the congregation is notified, we need to go back and check on some things. We can do that. But that is the process. That's kind of really what happens in a lot of churches today. So it's not like I've invented anything. You will submit them to ocldership@gmail.com. And any questions that you want. And then we'll just keep you up to date through announcements. This slide will go out so you don't have to picture it, you know. The team will meet to determine the appropriate steps forward, and just any decision will follow a consensus. I don't believe in unanimity decisions in most cases. You know why? It gives power to one person to always say no to everything. And I've seen that happen in two churches, where that person is always the no person. They say, but we had consensus. No, you had unanimity. You didn't have consensus. Consensus would have a threshold. It could be like 60%, 70, 80. But I think that's how we would do it here. Now, we're coming down to the wire here, okay? So You will be involved. We're asking you, as we get closer, to be involved in prayer and fasting. Okay? You know what? It's been a long time since I've done a really old-fashioned fast where I didn't, like, cut corners, you know, just find the 24 hours as the least sacrificial, you know. Okay. I think we need to do a really good fast. And perhaps even do some studying on what that means. Fasts were part of major decisions in the book of Acts. So we're inviting the Holy Spirit to lead us, to help us through this process. Okay, now, this is Oahu. They appointed elders in a process very much like this. What's interesting, I had to pull out of coaching them. And then when they appointed elders, there were two names I didn't recognize. I knew all the candidates all the time up until I pointed out, but there were some that had emerged. So once they brought it to the church, I had been pulled out. New people emerged. They went through a vetting process, and boom, they had an eldership, and they still do have that eldership. Metro just had an eldership process last year, 2022. What's powerful about this picture? I just got to tell you, here's what's powerful about this picture. I was consulting for this ministry in 2018, early 2019. And Pablo and Nicole will tell you, there are people up there that were not on the same side of some things. Some schism, faction thing was going on. So not only did we witness repentance at an atonement meeting, we saw real reconciliation. And then this led to Robert being hired, Robert Michelle, and Robert took over. And that's the eldership is a credit to the Carrillos. So great picture up there, awesome people. And then lastly, in October of 2023, the Knoxville Church, under 60 members, had 200 people out for a 30-year anniversary, former members, and some of them are coming back to the church. I mean, it's a very encouraging story, but on that day, they appointed two elders with this same process. So it's sound, it's rooted in Scripture, it trusts God, it's not about man, it's not about perfection, it's about studying the Scriptures, seeing what God is trying to do. And I'll tell you what, if you have a strong eldership, you won't be needing to bring in consultants. Okay, you would bring them in for small works, do a weekend retreat, do a workshop, you know. But a strong eldership will help this church be healthy. And at this time, Robert's going to come up. There is a resource up there I want you to know about.